Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. In this episode, we present part three of the Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's 75th Anniversary Symposium, which was held at Columbia University on September 30th of this year. The panel that takes up this segment provides an intimate look at the work of the magazine's previous editors, Frederick Denay and Eleanor Sullivan, as well as providing insights into the contributions to the magazine's direction made by Manfred B. Lee and Clayton Rawson. EQMM's Editors at Work, as this panel is titled, is moderated by Joseph Goodrich. Joseph Goodrich is an author and dramatist whose plays have been produced across the U.S. and in Canada. His adaptation of Ellery Queen's Calamity Town was named Best New Script at the 2016 Calgary Theatre Critics Awards, and the Park Square Theatre in St. Paul, Minnesota has commissioned his second Nero Wolfe adaptation for production in 2017. His play Panic won the 2008 Edgar Award for Best Play. Joe is the editor of Blood Relations, The Selected Letters of Ellery Queen, 1947 to 1950, which was nominated for Anthony and Agatha Awards. His fiction has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, Noir Riot, Dark Corners, Bullet, Vacant Funhouse, and two MWA anthologies. He is an alumnus of the New Dramatists, an active member of the Mystery Writers of America, and a former Calderwood Fellow.
Thanks as well to Janet Hutchings, Jackie Sherbo, and all at Dell Magazines, and to Jennifer B. Lee and the staff at the Butler Library. I've spent a great deal of time at the Butler over the years when I was working on Blood Relations, and I can attest to the kindness, the civility, and the helpfulness of all who work here. On April 9, 1939, Raymond Chandler, the gloriously pugnacious Raymond Chandler, wrote a letter to fellow scribe George Harmon Cox. Are there any Flash Gun Casey fans? I would hope so, on a day like this. Among other topics, Chandler wrote about Joseph T. Shaw, erstwhile editor of Black Mask magazine. Chandler, and many other writers, owed a lot to Shaw, who at this point had tried to be an agent and failed. Chandler was commiserating with George Harmon Cox about Shaw, and in the course of his letter, he wrote, "I agree with you that he, Shaw, ought to have a magazine. I'd like to see him have the magazine which for years I've wondered somebody did not think worth publishing, a high-class pulp story magazine, aimed at the rather large class of people who find the pulps mostly too juvenile and who don't like the big magazines because of their fundamental dishonesty in the matter of character and motivation." Joseph Shaw never created such a magazine, but 2.5 years later, in the fall of 1941, Fred Denay, in conjunction with Lawrence E. Spivak, did. Such was the strength of Denay's vision, a publication that would present the best and most varied work of the mystery genre, stories that would appeal to the readers Chandler wrote of. Such was the strength of that vision that EQMM has endured, prospered, and provided a home for tyros and old pros, grandmasters and young Turks for 75 years and counting. It's been my pleasure to work with Janet Hutchings and with Linda Landrigan of AHMM, but it was not, alas, in the cards that I should have the chance to work or even meet Fred Denay or Eleanor Sullivan. But today, I have the great good fortune to speak with three marvelous writers who have. In alphabetical order, they are Russell Atwood, Josh Pachter, and Otto Penzler. All three are formidable figures in the mystery world, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to speak with them about EQMM's editors. We have their bios here, and I could say you know them all, and you do, but I think their achievements are worth listing officially and publicly one more time. Russell Atwood is a former managing editor of EQMM and the author of short stories and two well-received novels. His interviews with mystery writers such as Reginald Hill and Colin Dexter have appeared in Biography magazine. He has also written live shows, including the adult puppet comedy, The Nicky, Jameson, and Fred Show. His most recent venture is the opening of a combination rare bookshop slash performance art space called Mostly Mystery in Westfield, Massachusetts. Josh Pachter debuted in EQMM in 1968 at the age of 16, the second youngest fiction contributor ever. As Sinatra would say, ring a ding ding. Over the almost half century since, he has contributed to EQMM another four dozen solo stories, collaborations, and translations of fiction by Dutch and Belgian authors. The Tree of Life, a collection of his Mahbub Chaudhry stories, I got that right, was published in 2015, as was Styx, a novel he wrote in collaboration with Belgium's Bavo Duge. Otto Penzler is the proprietor of the Mysterious Bookshop in New York City, and the founder in 1975 of the Mysterious Press, now in print at Grove Atlantic. He also publishes original works in classic crime fiction through mysteriouspress.com. The editor of more than 60, count them, 60 anthologies, including 20 volumes of the best American mystery stories of the year. He's won two Edgars for best critical work and is a recipient of both the Ellery Queen and Raven Awards. As I said, this is a venerable and most accomplished panel. Let's begin with Otto. This is a question I will address all of you in turn. When did you first come across Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine? And what was your first encounter with its editor or editors?
Well, I came across the magazine probably later than most. When I was a kid, I didn't really read mystery fiction. It doesn't speak well of me, but I was an English major at University of Michigan, and when I came home to New York, I decided that I wanted to read for fun instead of reading Russian novelists and T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, which may be brilliant, but not so much fun. And that's about when I started reading crime fiction and mystery fiction and came across a batch of old issues of Ellery Queen, and I was introduced to them, to the magazine, in the 40s, the magazines from the 40s, not the new ones, and just became hooked on not only the magazine, but on so many of the writers to which I was introduced through the pages of the magazine. The second part is, when did I first meet Fred? I think that's what you asked.
Yes, indeed, yes.
I think I ran into him at one or two Edgar Awards. We were introduced in passing, but I meant nothing to him. I was a sports writer. I wasn't involved in the mystery world, so we didn't know each other. But once I was commissioned with my friend and partner, Chris Steinbrenner, to write a book called The Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection, I corresponded with every living writer to that magazine. And so I had a pretty good correspondence with Fred, who wound up, when I started Mysterious Press, I had a lot of correspondence with him, a lot of phone conversations with him. And the first, and probably, I'm trying to remember if I ever did another reprint of any other book, and I don't think I did. I think the only reprint I ever did was the 50th anniversary, the golden anniversary of, who broke the prop? That wasn't that wasn't me. Nice building. And I published the golden anniversary. I got Fred to write a new introduction, telling about the history of the book and so on, which was just great. I was very proud to do it. And then eventually Fred hired me to write for the magazine. I had two columns simultaneously. One was an interview column where I would interview the most famous writers in the world. And the other was a book column, but it wasn't a book review column. There was already a regular reviewer. I can't remember now if it was Al Hubin or John Breen, but there was another full-time reviewer. And it was a column that just was about mystery fiction. It could be maybe a little bit about a movie or a play or an upcoming book or gossip, you know, something interesting about the mystery field. And that was the column that I wrote, one of the two columns that I wrote for Fred for about 2.5 or 3 years.
How attentively did he edit these pieces? What was his input? Or were you given a free hand?
Fred was certainly interested in editing fiction. Famously, would feel very comfortable basically rewriting, putting new titles, with or without permission, in a very heavy editorial hand. He didn't have to edit my interviews because, they were interviews. And there wasn't very much editing because I wasn't writing fiction. If you can write a good, simple, declarative English sentence, there's not much editing that you need to do for the kind of column that I was writing. And so I never had the sense that Fred edited at all. And if he did, it was so minor that when I read the magazine when it came out, I was looking for my column first, and then everything else second. Never had the sense that he had been playing with it at all.
I remember a great piece in the Mystery Newsletter. You did, I think it was an interview, it must have been, with Levinson and Link on 1980. Lovely, lovely pieces.
Levinson and Link, Dick Levinson and Bill Link were the creators of Columbo, as well as Murder, She Wrote, and many other television
and
series.
And the Hillary Queen TV series, which I hope you'll have the six DVD set at this point.
They got their first story.
Indeed, yeah.
That's right.
Must have been your first story. Yeah. Josh, your first encounter with the magazine, and what led you to the hallowed halls of 343 Lexington? Would that be a present?
That sounds right.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, I grew up on Long Island, and my ninth grade English teacher, Mary Ryan, one day told me to stay after school, and I thought, what did I do wrong? But what she wanted was to give me a copy of the June 1966 issue of the QMM. I have no idea why. I didn't know who Mary Ryan was. I think I probably knew who Sherlock Holmes was, but that was about it. But I took the magazine home, and because she gave it to me, I read it, and I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. And so from June 66 on, every month I would walk a mile and a half up Old Jerusalem Road in Levittown to the candy store where I would plunk down my quarter and buy a copy of the magazine. And at that time,
35 cents.
Was it 35 cents?
Yeah.
See, memory fades. In my memory, it will always be a
okay.
But at that time, the magazine was doing two reprint anthologies a year, every 6 months. And one of them came out in 1967. There was a story in it by a guy named Richard Deming. It was a story called Open File. It was a police procedural. At the end of the story, the cops failed to solve the crime, which is why it was called Open File. And I was 15 years old, and I thought, stupid cops, there's enough in the story, you should be able to know who done it. So I sat down with my little blue manual typewriter and I typed up a new ending to the story. Put it in an envelope, sent it to, what was it, three?
Whatever
it was. Sent it in, and a couple of weeks later, I got a little envelope in the mail, a little blue letter that I had. And I opened the envelope up and it was a two-page handwritten letter from Fred Deming, which is now unfortunately long lost, but I can quote the last two sentences. He wrote, have you ever considered writing a detective story yourself? Seems to me, Josh, if I may, you should. So I did. I wrote a story, and he gave me his home address, and I sent it to him directly. And a couple of months later, a month or so later, I was upstairs in my bedroom in Levittown when the phone rang downstairs in the kitchen. And my mother in the kitchen picked it up and yelled up the stairs, Josh, it's for you. And I yelled down, well, who is it? And my mom yelled back up, it's Frederick Danet. And I'm 16 years old. I came clomping down the stairs and I snatched up the phone. And I said, this is not funny, Dad. telling me that he liked and wanted to buy my story. So we spoke quite a bit on the phone and we corresponded a lot. And then I think I probably met him for the first time at an NWA, maybe an Edgar banquet, probably around 1970 or 71. And he, like everyone, was just very, very, very gracious to me. I was this little punk kid in awe of all these luminaries, but they all, beginning with Fred, they all took me under their wing and treated me not like a punk kid, but like a crime writer, which was something that I've never satisfactorily been able to say thank you for. thank you to you and Richard for your dad's kindness.
He meant every word.
And your mom's.
The relationship with E.Q. Amen has lasted over the years, certainly, as a writer of original works and translation. When did the translation come into focus? And did Fred and A. work with you on those? Was that one of their stuff? Or where the process of that? Oh, I'm sorry, sure. I was asking when did the translations begin, and who did you work with on them?
Well, the first one was in the early 1980s when I was living in Holland, and I happened to be fluent in Dutch. I don't happen to be fluent in Dutch. I learned Dutch. Some of you will remember a writer named Jan Willem van de Velde.
Yes.
And Jan Willem was weird. He was an Amsterdam cop. He was a Zen Buddhist monk, and he had written two nonfiction books about Zen and a series of crime novels about two Amsterdam cops, Grijpstra and De Geer, or Grijpstra and De Geer. Jan Willem wrote his novels in, if I remember this correctly, he wrote his novels in English, but he wrote his short stories in Dutch. And then he translated the short stories into English himself. But there came a time when he was busy with some new novel, and he had a new short story that needed to be translated, and he didn't have time to do it. So Eleanor knew that I spoke Dutch and contacted me and asked me if I would do the translation. And I did. It was a story called There Goes Ravelar! Exclamation point. And by the time it was published, I had done a second one. And then the first one, There Goes Ravelar, was nominated for Best Short Story Editor, something that Jan Willem's own translations of his stories had not accomplished, so I never got asked to do another one.
You might want a favor.
Yeah. But then, around maybe 2004 or so, when Janet brought the Passport to Crime feature into the magazine, she contacted me, living in the States by then, and asked me if I could find her a story by a Dutch writer. And since 2004, I've been doing them pretty regularly.
Since Eleanor Sullivan has been mentioned, whom I've always found an intriguing figure, there's not a great deal known about her. Perhaps people in this room may have known her, and therefore know about her. But I mean, the public record is, it seems to me, to be very brief. There's the piece in Murder, Inc., the late Dillis Wynne's collection, where she writes about reading a slush pile for EQMN. And there's a piece in one of the recent issues of EQMN about her, but there's not a lot known. So this seems to me to be a good opportunity to pass the torch to you, the mic, I should say, to you, Russell, and tell us about EQMN and how you got there, and Ms. Sullivan.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, I love Janet so much. She's done such a great job with the magazine. But I do feel definitely need to talk about Eleanor Sullivan, because she was an amazing woman. For a while there, she was editing both Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock, and she managed to keep the editorial vision of both kind of intact. I mean, Alfred Hitchcock does more of a suspense magazine than a detective's, but just the idea that she managed to like manage both those magazines for a while. And then Kathleen Jordan came on, and Kathleen was an amazing editor. And then they managed to work together, where if a manuscript came in that seemed more of a Alfred Hitchcock thing, she would like pass it over to Kathleen. And so they really had a great dynamic that helped both magazines like prosper for those years and stuff. But she was an amazing woman. And just a hard worker. I mean, she would just come in and go through the slush pile. And I was very fortunate. The story I want to tell is that I was actually at this event for the Roman Hat Mystery, and I got to meet Ellery Queen when I was about 12 years old or something like that. And then I went on to college and edited a campus magazine, and I thought I was a literary person. And when I moved to New York, I was trying to get a job someplace, and I applied at Spy, which was a magazine at the time in New York. And then I sent a letter to Ellery Queen saying, oh, I met Fred Danet when I was 12. And I immediately got an interview with Eleanor, and I was hired within like 2 weeks, and I worked there for a year, and we were just doing regular work so we could like talk. And at one point we got into an argument, and I was just like, well, why did you hire me if you didn't think I was this great editor? And it's like, I only hired you because you met Fred Daly. And I was like taken aback, but I was like, well, I'm glad I have this job, so that's okay, I don't mind it. But it was the truth, but it was so true. The whole reason I had that job was because I met Fred Daly when I was 12. So there's a sort of a nepotism. On the train right here, I was like, that's what I love about Ellery Queen, Mystery Magazine, and the whole mystery world in general, is it's very family oriented. And it doesn't have to be a blood relation, but, oh, you love this story? I love this story. And one of the greatest things working there was once a month, Isaac Asimov would come in with a new Black Widower story, and he would sit down with Eleanor and we would talk. And then once a month, Ed Hoke and Pat Hoke would come in, and we would go out and have lunch. And Ed is so missed by me, and I'm sure by everybody else in this room, because the enthusiasm he had for the puzzle, for the mystery. I don't know anybody else in my life. He was like one of the few people I know. We get into the business of mystery writing and stuff, like, but he just loved, like, oh yeah, did you like that red herring I put in there? And he loved that so much, and the enthusiasm, and the fact that I got to like spend time with Ed Hoke was incredible.
You certainly kept the puzzle mystery alive in a changing era, through changing era.
Absolutely, and just the fact that he just loved it too. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm just like trying to get a paycheck every month. He loved fooling the readers. And, I love that too, and so I was like, that's why I got into it. I wanted to be Jim Hutton.
I think many people in this room wanted to be Jim Hutton.
And then I met Fred Denny, and he's like this little, like, you know, garden gnome kind of a guy. Wow. He wrote this thing that I now, and so then that, it makes it more accessible too. I'm like, wow, I don't have to be, you know, James Bond to write this. I can be this guy who just like enjoys this kind of process. That was great.
Yeah. Otto, did you deal with Eleanor Sullivan?
I did. She was the editor of Ellery Queen magazine when I had my column there. Although generally I would send the things directly to Fred, but then he would pass them on to Eleanor. Or sometimes it was the other way around. I didn't really know who my editor was because nobody edited me.
Sure.
Nobody called to say, hey, you idiot, you know. So I
got those calls.
But yeah, I do. One thing I remember about Eleanor is she had a great apartment in the Murray Hills section of New York.
Like Turtle Bay, right across
Turtle
the
Bay,
street.
Turtle Bay. Susan
Sondheim was her
adjacent
neighbor.
And it was a brownstone. And all the brownstones, apparently on both sides of the street, overlooked this giant community garden.
And Catherine Hepburn was another neighbor.
Exactly. And I remember going to a party there and thinking, this is so cool. I want this. And I'm 74. I still want it.
How would you describe Eleanor as a person? Brisk, sharp, smart?
No, on the contrary, no.
I'm just throwing words out because I don't like you. But.
No, on the contrary. She was very understanding. I mean, if you would talk to her about a difficulty or, you know, a deadline that you might be pressed against and so on. Is he late again? No, not at all sharp. I never once knew her to be crisp or any other way than gentle and kind and thoughtful. She was warm. It was common to get a hug rather than a handshake, which I like. I like being hugged by women. So anybody feel free.
There'll be a hugging session after the end.
As I said, we didn't have day-to-day connection because or even week-to-week sometimes barely month to month. I usually mailed in my columns rather than bring them in, because I had a real job. So that didn't happen too much, but for the, I don't know, several years that I knew her, but both before I had the column and after, I had nothing but warm feelings about her.
I just want to say just one thing as far as her editing goes. Well, we would get manuscripts from Ruth Rendell, and for the most part, we wouldn't touch them, but I think part of the editing also, you would have to just like tweak things and like add like, oh, like I think it'd be better if there's like a comma instead of an and. And I was always impressed with like, oh, you can do that to Ruth Rendell. You can edit Ruth Rendell. It was very light though, but it was just a sense of like, yeah, she always, Eleanor always tended to like edit just a little bit because that's her job, you know, and trying to also make it uniform to all the stories look alike. I'm going to say problem. It wasn't a problem, but like we published a Harlan Ellison story, and Eleanor had done like 36 little tweaks, and he called me on the phone, and we got it down to like under 34. So like I changed like 34 of the tweaks because he's like, no, this is how I wrote it. This is how it's supposed to be published. And so I spent a nice hour and a half on the phone with Harlan Ellison, like changing it back to the way he'd done. But there were just every now and then, you know, just kind of like tweak. But no, for the most part, she let people alone. But still, she would take classic people and like tweak them and do things, and nobody noticed. And no, she had a good feel for that. So
that's the job.
Exactly. The job. Exactly. Yeah. You know, just.
There's a famous story about a period piece that Fred Denay was editing, and he didn't like the exposition. The dialogue was all right, but the exposition needed real work. So since it was set in the Victorian era, he simply got out a copy of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and took phrases, because it was an older domain, and transposed phrase by phrase. If someone needed to cross to the door, drop it to a Stevenson. Someone that puts on a hat, lights a cigar, whatever, lights a cigar, take that out, drop it to a Stevenson. It's quite a It seems to me there are a couple of shadow figures, as it were, in the editing of E.T. Lemon, or people behind the scenes. One of them would be Clayton Rawson, and the other would be, in a way, Manny or Manfred B. Lee. I'd like to talk a bit about both. Did you know Clayton Rawson was going on?
I'm so glad you asked me that. The very first Edgar banquet that I went to, which was 1970, Clay was still alive. I don't know how many of you know the great Merlini, his great character. He was a master of the locked room impossible crime story. And he had a personality, I don't want to say disorder, but he was, he would go from manic depressive to manic happy and joyous. And that night he was happy. He was in a great mood. And I was there with Chris Steinbrenner, with whom I was writing this book, this encyclopedia. We were friends. Maybe we weren't even writing it yet, but we were friends for some time. And Chris knew Clay and introduced me, and we got to chatting. And after about 5 minutes, Rawson said, "Listen, I'm staying in the hotel. Why don't you guys come up to my room? I want to show you some magic. He was a magician himself. And we missed the entire cocktail party, which was fine with me because, believe it or not, I did not drink in those days. I've been catching up ever since. And Clay was up there in the room doing sleight of hand, just extemporaneously talking, telling stories about the early years of MWA, his friends who were mystery writers, as he's doing all of these amazing sleight of hand magic. It was the only time I ever met him, but it was a memorable time. I got to know his son, Hugh Rawson, fairly well, and now I publish all of Clay Rawson's books electronically. But that was the only time I met him. But that was such a warm memory, going to the Edgars for the first time, where you don't know anybody, and all of your heroes are in the room, and suddenly you feel this wonderful embrace of one of the giants of the field, who is taking good care of you.
You must have felt like you've been invited into the sanctum sanctorum.
Absolutely, and it's a memory that stays with me, as so few things do these days.
Your great Marlene additions were great. I love those.
Wasn't those great?
They're so beautiful.
Josh, you also.
Thanks.
I got to know Clay fairly well. Like Otto, I went to the University of Michigan.
And go blue.
Yeah. Wolverines forever.
Hail to the victory.
Sorry, we just get a little carried away sometimes. When I would come home for holidays, I would always go into the magazine offices and visit with them on the Clayton, whatever he was doing, he always would set it aside and make time for me. And he would send out for sandwiches. We'd have lunch together. And the memory for me that stands out the most was one day I showed up at the office and he got us some sandwiches. And he fished out of his jacket pocket a book of paper matches. And he threw it to me. I caught it. And he said, light a match. So I lit a match. And Clayton opened his mouth and said, throw it into my mouth. And I said, no. And he insisted I had to throw this lit match, and it was burning down, so I had to get rid of it. I threw it into Clayton's mouth, and he said, now the next one. And I sat there and lit 20 paper matches and threw them one by one, blazing into Clayton Rawson's mouth. He was practicing something. But he was always very, very kind and gracious to me. So was Eleanor. Eleanor was like a big sister to me. I remember I had a big furry winter coat that I my parents had bought me at Barney's Boy Scout. And in the winter I used to wear this. It was horrible, it was a terrible coat. Eleanor loved this coat, and we would often go out to lunch together, and she would always want to wear the coat, which meant I had nothing. I was freezing, but Eleanor was nice and warm in my furry coat. And I remember one time it was not winter, and I showed up to visit with her, and she said, "You're not wearing the coat. I'm busy." She was kidding. She wasn't. At least not too busy. But I remember very vividly Eleanor in my coat.
Yeah. The title of the story.
Yeah, Eleanor in my coat.
Yeah. Wasn't Clayton Rawson the editor of the magazine for a while?
For a little while.
Yeah.
Interning managing editor, I guess. Yeah. Would that be the title?
Yeah, I don't think he was technically editor in chief. He was managing editor, but I think he was really playing.
Well, there was
the
that, there's that I don't know if it's apocryphal about the story of the trick he does with the magazine.
No, that's true.
That is true, where you turn to a certain page and
problems.
The word is...
Problems. That issue still exists.
Okay, so... Which issue is it?
Why don't you tell us what that is?
Josh knows better than I do.
Well, I
suppose those might not know.
Who knows
the
best
trick? It's a trick. You turn to a page and...
Yeah, Fred was friends with... I wish I could remember the guy's name. He was friends with a professional magician. Not Clayton, another one. And the magician, Richard Himber, yes. And, well, maybe you should tell
him. That's the end of my knowledge.
Richard Himber asked Fred to help him to design a prop for his magic act.
And like a mind reading.
Yeah, well, the issue had, I think it was 10 stories in it, and the way it worked in the act was that Himber would hand the magazine off to a randomly selected audience member or volunteer. And you were supposed to open up to the first page of any story. And you didn't have to identify the story, you just had to say what page it started on. And Richard Himber would do his mind reading pattern and tell you the that manyth word in the story. If the story began on page 23, the 23rd word of the story, would be the word problems. And Fred had edited the beginnings of each of the stories so that no matter which of the 10 stories we selected, the that manyth word of the story was always the word problems.
That's great. Wow, I had that kind of control.
Yeah.
You see the mind there that composed those brain-bustingly difficult plots.
Yeah, no, it's true. No, today,
We spoke about Manfred B. Lee. Did you meet Manfred?
Never met him.
I did. And I think only one time that I can recall. I met him at an Edgar banquet. And it must have been the last one that Mr. Lee went to before he passed away, I think. And I was there. What year did he die?
71.
71, yeah. So I think it was 1970, which was also the first one that I went to.
Oh, my God. We're like twins.
And yet, Fred and I were talking, and he said, oh, I want you to meet Manny Lee. And he led me over to where Mr. Lee was and introduced me. And we spoke, not for a long time, but he was very nice, very pleasant. I think that in my memory, which again isn't always right, but in my memory, I remember him seeming really tired. And I think maybe by then he was pretty ill.
I think that's true. He had heart problems and lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
Because of the heart. And it was not well. Material that I didn't put in my collection of, I put together a collection of letters between Fred Denis and Manfred B. Lee, compiled upstairs on the sixth floor. And so much fascinating material I could have put in, but I focused on the writing of some of the better known and I think lasting books. But there was a long section where Denis is in Larchmont and Manfred B. Lee is in California supervising Ellery, the radio show, The Adventures of Ellery Queen. And it seems to me that the magazine was always a kind of bone of contention between Denis and Lee. But Lee did try to involve himself with it in certain ways. There's a lengthy series of letters that chronicle Lee going to the LA Public Library and reading back issues of stories to find material to reprint in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. I think in the first time we talked about, or it was talked about how the originally reprint was originals and the shift occurred. Manny B. Lee worked so hard to find stories and synopsize them and send them off to Fred Denis, who would say, kindly but pointedly, read it. Published before. Doesn't work. Not a mystery. So I think the magazine was fraught territory. Something that Lee had no interest or taste in, but it felt bad about being left out of. That's my take on it. There's someone else we should mention, and that's Constance de Rienzo.
Constance.
Was she the, how would you describe what she was?
I was seeing contracts. Behind the scenes, definitely, yeah. I mean, like, making all this stuff happen, yeah.
I don't think, Connie didn't have any kind of an editorial function at all, but she took care of everything in the office.
We got the rights to things through her. I mean, because that's the thing, you want to make sure the writer gets it.
Always very nice, always, I remember, she was tall. Maybe I was just short. always just absolutely wonderfully polite and friendly. She was the one, I knew her. I saw her 100 times. But I never really felt like I got to know her. It was always more formal with company. It was more a business relationship.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You need that business person behind all this, so, you know, be all fancy and stuff. But yeah, we need to get the contract signed and the addresses right. A lot of times you have to track down, like, authors change their addresses. You have, like, we have to, like, do, like, yeah, you have, like, I need to get your rights just so I can publish your story again. Then you have to, like, do a little detective work just to, like, track them down.
Given the variety of material that's published in the magazine over the years, I'm wondering if, with Fred Denis and with Ms. Sullivan, if there were any particular taboos or stories they didn't want to see, subjects they didn't want to deal with, any problems encountered?
Lots of taboos.
Such as?
Curse words. Any kind of a crime that involved a child as the victim or as the criminal. anything that even smacked of sex. It was on the covers, but it wasn't between the covers. So I remember somewhere along the line, I don't know if I was the first person to do this, and Janet, you would know, but I was translating a story by a Dutch author, and the story included in English the word fuck. And I thought, how do you translate that into English for Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine? And I thought, you can't, so I just left it alone, and it did in fact appear in the magazine.
Very occasionally.
Yeah.
David Dean, is he still, he's still?
Yeah.
Yes, I think one of his early stories, he had a dead German shepherd in a trunk of a car, and the dog was dead, and it was fiction. No dog actually was killed, but we got like a lot of letters, people like, why did you kill that dog? So we did, it's a fiction story. It was about devil worshippers, and the detective found it. Anyway, but that was like, we had so many letters, and that was like, well, that was the other thing too. It's like, you do these things, and like, everybody's like really happy, and it goes along, and nothing happens. And then like one crazy person writes a letter to the publisher, and then suddenly it's like, well, we can't do any more apron stories or whatever. Why? It's like one person, but that's the thing. Like, just one letter would like make the publisher be like, oh, I got a letter here now.
And apron stories are so old school.
We got a lot of, we did get a lot of letters with like the dog in the trunk of the car. Like,
we didn't actually put a dog in the trunk of the car.
So would you say that a freer or less censorious approach to material is marks the magazine now? How would you say the magazine has changed from the time you first started reading it to at least what it was then to what it is now?
I mean, personally, I just think like the general reading public is a little more calmed down. So I think it opens things up just for Ellery Queen because, I mean, you see things so much worse on TV now. I mean, the stuff that on, you know, like on Law and Order, Ellery Queen wouldn't have necessarily done because it was a little too racy, a little too sexual. But now it's like, I think the doors are open. Now it's like, you can see that on TV.
Did you
hear
about it?
Yeah.
I wouldn't call the magazine racy even today, but it certainly is it is more open to tougher and grittier material than it used to be. And in fact, it has the black mass section, which is kind of hard-boiled fiction, which probably wouldn't have appeared in another era. It seems like it's a little bit tougher now. But you know, thinking back, In the early 40s, among the first writers who worked for the magazine were Cornell Woolrich and Dashiell Hammett. So, you know, I mean, of course, they were under certain control as well. So take back everything I just said. There's no
No, I mean, but I think the difference back then was that they would skate that edge, but if they weren't as explicit, I think it made them more artful in a way. They had to like get their terror in, you know, a little bit closer to the edge. I mean, like Stanley Ellen, for instance, is a great writer and so many great stories now. I mean, some of this stuff is still creepy today.
Looking at the magazine's longevity, there's some talk about that in the first panel. Boundary pushing, the variety of stories covered. Let me ask you, Otto, as a publisher, as a long-time man in the publishing business and an editor, are those the reasons for its longevity? Are there other reasons? And what do you think the future holds for magazines like Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine?
And well, actually, that was addressed in the first panel. Yeah. You know, I think we all agree. Yeah. We all agree, I think, that the reason for its success and success longevity going together is the wide range of material in the magazine and the high level of that within that wide parameter of stories that it uses. the future is hard to know. You know, we all worry about the printed books and magazines. Are they becoming a little bit passé as e-books and e-readers become more successful, and as a lot of younger people spend a lot less time reading than people of our age did when we were their age, and we've continued to read, will they come to reading later if they're 25 now and still playing Xbox games or whatever that thing is? Will they suddenly at 40 learn to read and decide that, yeah, I'm going to pick up a magazine and read it, or pick up a book and read it? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I fear for it. But, you know, I feared more 5 years ago. 5 years ago, all we heard about was the decline of the book, and book sales are going down, and independent bookshops are closing. And we heard about it over and over again. In the last 5 years, more independent bookshops have opened than closed. And e-readers, and I publish e-books, so I'm not unhappy about the success of electronic books, mind you. However, the number of books sold in that format has plateaued over the last 3 years. And every year in the fall, it sounds like I'm digressing, but I'm not. In the fall, there's a program that Duke University has called Duke in New York, where a class comes up from Duke University and spends the semester in New York. They go to the Met, they go to every museum, they go to the ballet, they go to Madison Square Garden, they go to Yankee Stadium, and they come to my bookshop. And I give an hour talk about the history of mystery. And I talk to these kids, about 25 of them, and ask them about their reading. And I won't go through all the questions that I asked to get there, but I learned that every single one of those kids, without exception, everyone reads fiction, reads for fun, and reads physical books. They do their homework, they do their research, they do their studying online or on their iPad, pod, but for reading for pleasure, they walk around with physical books. And that gave me so much hope and joy for the future.
On that happy note, and this is very happy, we have time for a couple of questions if anyone has them. You've got a lovely group of experts here. Yes, sir, in the back. Can we get them? Thank you.
I agree. I think that we just have to kind of wait out that guy.
Nobody here really knows me, but let me just say that I work for Peter Cantor, and one of my jobs is to sell these magazines at newsstands and meet with retailers. And something that you all were just talking about, you know, are the young people going to read these things? I just returned this week from a conference, Barnes & Noble store managers, and we had a booth set up and we had these magazines out. And I was very impressed and enthused by the number of store managers. I mean, I could probably count them with two hands, but still, that were young. These store managers, probably 40 or a little bit younger, who were very enthusiastic about these titles and, you know, asked us, how can we get more people to read these titles? You know, we talked about it for a while. So there are people out there thinking about it and trying to figure out how to engage younger folks in it. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Anyone else? Okay.
My name is Cindy Liu. I'm from China. I was a book editor before. So nowadays, now I sit down in New York City. My question is like, now you are doing reading in electronic books. But what do you think of the physical book? What do you think of the future of physical books? And that's a big topic, just because of the digital era.
The fate of the physical book. It seems to be doing well.
Yeah, I certainly hope Otto is right.
So I would know better than Otto. I'm seeing more people walking around with physical books.
Yeah.
I think it's something.
Yeah.
I think that we need to adjust. I mean, it's great to have electronic books, especially because I'm a big fan of like first editions that I can't get. So like, if I see an ebook of a Melville Davidson post that I would have to spend $300 to get a first edition of, I'll get the ebook just so I can read that. And so I like that the fact some of the old people are coming back. I would prefer to read the new Jeffrey Deaver in hardcover though. So that's just the way it is.
I have Melville Davison post editions in my store for a lot less than $300.
There's a question over here. Yes, sir.
Hi, everybody. I'm Fred Kaminsky, mystery fan. And Ellery Queen is so close to my feeling of living my life. I'm 72 years old, and I'll never forget, I was 16, and I read the Roman Atmosphere, and I was hooked. And then the greatest mystery thriller of all time with a whodunit. I'm not going to tell you the murderer. You kill me. The Tragedy of Y. A masterpiece. And just throwing it off the subject a little matter, I remember once listening to a radio show on WOR, and they had two people who had this book out called The Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection. A man named Otto Penzler and Chris Schubiner. And whatever happened, I said, man, that sounds like the book to get to learn everything about murder and mystery movies, authors, everything. So I heard that there was this bookstore called The Mysterious Bookstore, and I went in there, and I looked up at the gentleman, and I said, look, I want The Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection. It's written by Otto Penzler. I'm Otto Penzler. Man, January 1980. And let me tell you, this man is one of my dearest friends in this whole world. I got to meet mystery writers. I got to help him at the airport. And I felt on top of the world. So if you want to go to a bookstore, go to Chambers Street, and it's the Mysterious Bookshop. You got three great helpers in there. They made me feel like a king. So I'm sorry I threw it off Ellery Queen, but if it wasn't Ellery Queen, maybe I would have known Otto Penzler. So probably.
That cost me a lot of money.
One more quick question. Going once, going twice. There we have it. Well, there it is. We'll draw things to a close. I want to thank you all for being here, for letting us all be here. It's been a delight to speak with, this time in reverse alphabetical order, Otto Penzler, Josh Packer, and Russell Lamb. Thanks again to Janet Hutchings, Jackie Sherbo, and Oliver Dell, Jennifer B. Lee, and everyone at the Butler Library. And I want to say, just on a personal note, as someone who's been reading EQ and EQMM since Disco Inferno was on the radio, the session has been such a delight and a pleasure and an honor to moderate this panel today. Thank you.
This podcast was recorded and edited by Che Ryback. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.